This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Ever wonder where certain pieces of information come in a case? Pieces of information that you look back on going, oh, how does that fit into the puzzle? Why are people saying this? Why are people stuck on this or fact or piece of information or accusation or rumor or whatever it may be? How did that get in there? We see it with every case that we cover. In this piece, we're going to be talking about Brian Koberger and the Idaho murders in the first 72 hours, because that really is your answer to a lot of those questions. What came out in the first 72 hours? Because there's a lot of misinformation that comes out. It's not because people are trying to deliver fake news or trying to persuade you this way or that way, although in some cases that can happen. But that's not most cases. Most of the time, that's the fog of war. When there's chaos going on, information, even from some of the most credible sources and the most well-meaning people, can be incorrect. That is how it's always been. That's nothing new. That's not a product of modern communication or social media. This existed back hundreds of years ago in newspapers' days. Look at early reporting on virtually anything in a newspaper from years ago when it's a breaking event. You will find so much information that was incorrect at the beginning. Now, that's not misinformation. Misinformation is designed to mislead. It's information that is found to be updated and incorrect. So let's go back to the first 72 hours in this case. November 13th of 2022, Moscow, Idaho, a sleepy college town with under 30,000 residents. It's not big. Kind of place where people don't lock their doors and your favorite barista probably knows your class schedule, not just your favorite drink. That morning, shortly before noon, a 911 call came in reporting an unconscious person at a house on King Road. First responders arrived. What they found wasn't someone unconscious. It was four people dead. Kaylee Gonzalez, Madison Mogan, Zanna Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin, all having their lives stolen from them in the early morning hours inside their off-campus rental home by Brian Koberger. Now, we didn't know the name Brian Koberger at that moment in time. At that moment in time, we had a word that was being thrown around, unconscious. And that was the first point of where the confusion began. The 911 call wasn't unusual for a college neighborhood, not on its face. An unresponsive person, maybe drinking, maybe passed out, maybe worse, but no one knew for sure. Friends had been called, dispatchers took the message at face value, and then law enforcement arrived and really set in. But that one word, unconscious, made it into every early police statement. And once the media picked it up, it lit a fuse. How could someone describe these as an unconscious person? Had no one checked for a pulse? Had they seen the bodies and said nothing? Did someone cover for the killer? All of these things cascade out of that one word. All fair questions until you understand what trauma does to language. People in shock don't speak clinically. They grab the first word that feels safe, even if it's wildly inaccurate. Unconscious isn't deception. It's terror with a vocabulary problem because of trauma. That's where the fog starts in this case. Not with lies, with uncertainty. Well, if I was in the situation, no one cares. No one cares how you would have handled it or what you would have done. And guess what? You don't know what you would have done because you weren't there and you didn't live it. So stop running everything through your prism and saying how you would have done it, because guess what? Like I said, no one gives a shit. All that matters is what happened to the people it happened to. By November 15th, 2 days later, the Moscow Police Department issued its first formal statement. They described the incident as a targeted attack. More importantly, they said this: there is no indication there is an ongoing threat to the community. Remember that? That sentence went viral. It was what people wanted to hear. Whatever had happened was contained. No random killer, no danger to others. A one-time tragedy. Not a great choice of words. It wasn't accurate. But it wasn't met with malice or meant with malice either. On November 16th, just one day later, Chief James Fry stood in front of a microphone and contradicted that message entirely. We cannot say there is no threat to the community. Again, why messaging is important, and words are important. This is a very small police force who has no history in dealing with anything like this. So give them a little grace when the messaging is a little bit dicey. Could it have been done better? Yes, everything could have been done better in virtually every aspect of life in general. Of anything we do, we can always do better. It's important just to recognize it, not to beat them down and say, you, it's to go, okay, next time, hopefully there's not a next time, but if there is a next time, here's how we might be able to handle this with less confusion. Nobody wants confusion. Nobody's out there, let's confuse the shit out of everybody while we're trying to solve this. No, that's not how it works. To the public, that sounded like someone had lied, but in reality, the situation had changed. Investigators had more information, maybe a lack of suspect, maybe inconsistencies, maybe just internal pressure to walk it back, but it wasn't malicious. It was procedural, and yet perception was already cemented. The public felt jerked around. First, it was safe. Now, it wasn't. First, it was targeted. Now, they weren't sure. That's the first rule of the fog. Once you tell people something, even if it's wrong, they will cling to it harder than the truth that comes after. Over the next 24 hours, the case left the realm of confirmed reporting and entered an entirely different world. Rumors exploded. One claimed that the victims were tied up and gagged. That was false. Another said that Kaylee had a stalker. Moscow PD looked into it. Well, we've learned a little bit more about that in the newly released documents. There were whispers that a dog had been found skinned in the area just days earlier, that it had to be connected. It happened, but it wasn't connected. People began pointing fingers at Kaylee's ex-boyfriend, at the DoorDash driver, at the guy in the food truck video, at the surviving roommates, all cleared, all investigated, none involved. The problem wasn't that people were asking questions. The problem was that those questions quickly became assumptions. And the assumptions calcified into beliefs. And the beliefs turned into rage when the official story didn't match the one the internet had already written. Because it's on the internet, it must be true, right? And nobody wants to be wrong. Especially if you've already reported it or tweeted it or posted it or whatevered it. By the end of November, the police department issued a formal clarification about one of the earliest, most misunderstood phrases, targeted attack. Turns out that when they said the crime was targeted, they didn't mean they knew who was targeted. They didn't even know if a person was targeted. It could have been the house. It could have been opportunity. They just knew it didn't appear random. But everybody interpreted it through their own prism. And it must mean something different to everybody, right? That's what they meant. It's a massive gap in clarity, but it's not an attempt to deceive. It's a reflection of real-time investigations. Still, to the public, this was proof of a cover-up. They were convinced people were lying. The idea that words could be so poorly chosen in crisis was too uncomfortable to accept. And look, we criticized the shit out of it right here. Because words matter. And that was the point of our reporting. Words matter. Do better, please. And they, when they look back on it, I think all agree. Then came the no signs of forced entry detail, another phrase that spiraled into theory overload. What does that even mean? To police, it means no visible damage, no kicked-in doors, no broken windows. It does not mean the door was locked. And in fact, later documents and reports would confirm that the likely point of entry was a sliding glass door, commonly left unlocked in that house. The kind of thing that looks less like conspiracy and more like college living. But that didn't matter. The public had already decided no forced entry means someone had a key. Someone let them in. The roommate knew. The victims knew. Someone on the inside was involved. I saw it on Reddit. It must be true. Some people still live in that state. And if that's you, as I often say, seek help. All of that wrong, but too late. Weeks later, police made a public ask. They were looking for a white Hyundai Elantra between models year 2011 and 2013. They believed the occupant might have critical information. That was a big ask. What the public didn't know was that investigators had already surveillance. They already had surveillance footage showing the exact model circling the crime scene multiple times during the early morning hours. What they also didn't say was that the car they were actually tracking, a 2015 Hyundai Elantra owned by Brian Koberger, wasn't in that year range. That wasn't a mistake, actually. That was deliberate. Keep the request vague enough to not tip off the suspect. Cast a wide net. Investigators do this all the time. It is a strategy. But again, the internet took it as incompetence. They don't even know what car it is. How can they be off by 2 years? They're guessing. No, they weren't. They were actually hunting. On December 30th, Koberger was arrested in Pennsylvania, and that's when the real information started to land. We learned about the DNA on the knife sheath, about the phone pings that placed him in the area multiple times before the murders, about surveillance video showing his car returning to the scene in the early hours of the 13th. We learned that his phone had been turned off during the killings, a textbook sign of premeditation and concealment, that he'd returned to the crime scene a few hours later, that he'd followed the case online, that he even drove back home across the country with his father, with police tailing him the entire way. The truth was chilling, but the noise? It was louder. Because even with this overwhelming evidence, some people still refused to let go of what they believed in the first 72 hours. They still claimed the ex-boyfriend was involved, still believed the roommates were lying, still pushed theories that had been debunked by sworn affidavits and just facts. This is a well-documented psychological phenomenon. In times of fear and uncertainty, the brain grabs onto the first story that offers coherence, the first theory that sounds like it makes sense. And it takes 10 times more effort to undo that belief than it did to form it. That's why so many people think corrections don't matter, because to them, the truth landed already, right there in the fog, before the facts, before the court, before reality even had a chance to speak. Reporters operate under immense pressure during the early stages of a crime like this. They get press releases, scanner traffic, vague quotes from officials, sometimes just silence, and they're expected to put out coverage that's accurate, timely, and shareable. Because if you're not, you must be hiding something. But the audience doesn't want updates. They want answers. When reporters update a story, when they correct a date, revise a quote, walk back a claim, the audience doesn't hear clarification. They hear manipulation. Because they're idiots. I mean, because... Even when it's just the normal evolution of an unfolding case. And that's reality. Don't be an idiot. Be educated. Think about these things. Understand these things. By the time the court system caught up with Koberger, hearings, motions, gag orders, delays, the public was already locked into 100 different versions of what they believed happened on King Road that night. And every one of them was right. At least in their minds. Some still think they are. And some actually were. They're not filing following the filings. They're not reading the affidavits. They're stuck in the fog, many of them. This case didn't just teach us about a killer. It taught us about ourselves, about how quickly we demanded closure, how little patience we have for process, how fragile truth becomes when a rumor feels more satisfying than a press release or real facts. The fog the first 72 hours isn't about deception. It's about delay. It's about that terrifying stretch of time between horror and understanding, the unknown, when clarity moves slower than panic and silence gets mistaken for cover-up. So the next time a crime breaks, pause before you run with a theory. Or at least don't be so dug in that that theory can't change or that you might be wrong. Before you pick your villain, before you retweet that screen grab that feels right, ask yourself, is this truth or is it just the first thing I heard? Because the fog always lifts. But if you're not careful, the version of the story you keep might be the one that never saw the light. Let me know your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. That is where you will find us. Do that same search wherever you download podcasts, and you'll find us anywhere. You get podcasts as well. Press subscribe. You can watch us on YouTube. You can take us on the go on the podcast platform, whatever you like. We're always here for you. We appreciate you listening. So please do check that out. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.